This month it marks the 91st, I know you had it on your calendar, anniversary of the day gangster Al Capone was indicted, and one of the most notorious criminals, and is really kind of associated with Chicago, for good or bad, probably for history. With us to talk about some little-known facts about Al Capone and his legal issues is Jonathan Eig. He's the author of the great book, Get Capone. He's a journalist here in Chicago, a biographer, and you offer five books, three of which are bestsellers. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Karen. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been a while. So let's talk a little bit about Al Capone and his legal issues, since this is a legal show. Elliot Ness is usually given the credit for nabbing Capone, but I think in your book you kind of take a different position. What is your position from all of your research?
Yeah, and Ness is the guy who we remember because of the TV shows and the movies, but he really had very little to do with putting Al Capone away. It was very hard to prove that Al Capone killed people. It was very hard to prove even that he sold liquor, that he kept his hands pretty clean. So the government became very frustrated, especially after the Valentine's Day massacre, and they couldn't prove that he had anything to do with that either. So they decided, we just got to get him off the streets. They were tired of this guy embarrassing them. And the city of Chicago wasn't going to do anything about it because Capone bribed everybody in town. I know you'll be shocked to hear that kind of thing happened. And luckily, it doesn't happen anymore. They finally decided the only way or the best way that they could get him out of that operation quickly, get him off the streets, was to make a tax case against him. So it's really the tax attorneys, the accountants, the guys and the U.S. attorney who led the investigation, George E.Q. Johnson, who deserve most of the credit. And to this day, their families are still kind of peeved that Elliot Ness gets all the credit.
Oh, that's interesting. So when they were putting together this case, they're looking at what his lifestyle and his expenditures, and kind of the idea that if he's only reporting X amount of dollars and he's spending Y amount of dollars, there's just no way that adds up.
Right. Well, first of all, Capone did not file income tax returns, and you and I probably wouldn't either if we were engaged in illegal business, right? So they went to him and they said, "Al, you never filed income tax returns. We're investigating you." So he actually went to D.C., met with the IRS officials and said, "Okay, I'll pay. Tell me, let's make a deal. Let's calculate how much I owe." And he offered an estimate of his income and offered to pay taxes on it. And they said, "No, we're going to keep looking into this." So they started building a case against him, and in fact, they used his estimated income during those negotiations as evidence against him. And they still couldn't prove that he had income because it was a cash operation. He didn't put his name in the books. He was, very smart about not leaving a paper trail. Eventually, they had to build the case around circumstantial evidence. They showed that he spent a lot of money, so he must have made a lot of money. And they just, they went into court and they talked about his dry cleaning bills and his home decorating bills and his cars and his houses and how much all this stuff costs. And they asked the jury to just use logic and say, if he's spending all this money, he must have been making money and he didn't pay any taxes. Let's put him away.
Interesting that doesn't sound like a laydown. That sounds like a little complicated.
It was complicated. And to be honest, if Capone had better lawyers, he might have had a chance of beating the case. But Capone made a mistake. He hired the lawyers who he knew who had worked with him before on his criminal charges. When he got arrested on suspicion of murder or suspicion of bootlegging, he had a bunch of guys that he knew well, that had served him well, that had kept him out of jail for a dozen or so years. And he turned to them to handle his tax case. And he should have hired tax experts. He should have hired somebody who knew how to deal with the IRS. And he really... that was, in some ways, of all the mistakes Capone made, he made plenty of them. That was the one that he paid for the most.
Well, and that's a moral of the story that I talk about all the time on the radio show, which is you got to get the right lawyer. And in a city like Chicago, and of course, it's 91 years later, you have so many lawyers who concentrate their practice in just one thing. And, in smaller towns, that's not the case. But, we have tons of really good tax lawyers. And the person who represents you in a murder case is a very different creature than a person who represents you in a paper crime. Not to say that some lawyers can't do both, but that's very, very interesting. So,
yeah, and if you look at the case, if you look at the trial transcripts, you can see how many mistakes they made. They really blew it.
Interesting. And let's just talk before we go to break. He goes to Alcatraz. He gets sentenced. How many years did he get sentenced to?
Income tax evasion, right? That's what he's convicted of.
Yeah.
He gets 13 years in federal prison today. No one has ever gone to prison for income tax evasion for anywhere near that length of time.
That's kind of a Blagojevich sentence.
Yeah. You can tell they were trying to send a message here.
They were.
This is not, because his brother went away before him for income tax evasion and only got a couple of years, which is pretty much the norm if you get do any time at all for income tax evasion. But 13 years at Alcatraz, come on.
Now, I don't know if any of you, I'm sure, John, you've been to Alcatraz, right?
Of course, yeah.
I have to tell you, it is a great tour. You go to San Francisco and take the little ferry over there, and it's a fascinating tour. And the idea that you're even there for a couple hours makes you just think, how could you do time here? It's cold, it's damp, the conditions are horrendous. How, from your research, how did Al Capone fare in prison, and how did he spend his time?
Well, it's really interesting. First of all, why send a tax evasion a guy to Alcatraz? It's because the prison was brand new and they wanted to get a lot of publicity for how tough it was to try to deter crime. So they sent the most famous gangster in the world there. And Al Capone, by the time he got there, had already been diagnosed with tertiary syphilis. So his mind was kind of starting to rot away already. He was really losing control of his bodily functions to some extent and his mind. And, he managed to learn to play the mandola while he was in prison.
Oh.
He learned to transcribe music. He wrote these sweet letters home to his mother and to his wife, apologizing for all the trouble he caused them. So it was interesting. He never, he was not a bad prisoner.
Interesting. Let's take a break. We're talking to Jonathan Eig. He's a very prominent Chicago author, and he has written numerous books. Muhammad Ali, A Life, which is what we're going to talk about next. It was made into a documentary produced by Ken Burns, and we're going to talk a little bit about Muhammad Ali's legal issues. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're talking to Jonathan Eig, the famous, world-famous Chicago-based author, and he is the author of his most recent book is Muhammad Ali, A Life, a biography of the great Muhammad Ali. Jonathan, I want to talk to you a little bit about your book, and it was made into a documentary by Ken Burns. How was it to work with him? It must have been a real pleasure.
Oh, my God, he's the best. It's like working with Muhammad Ali, the best in the business.
Right.
And he did, an 8-hour, 4-part documentary, and it was, 7 years of work. Then I got to see him, how he trains, how he operates in the ring. It was really great. I learned a lot about telling stories I learned a lot just from being around Ken and his whole team.
And let's talk, since this is a legal show, we're going to take there's probably a million things to talk about. I really like the whole part about Louisville. I was just in Louisville myself, and a lot of tributes to him there. But he came from a very segregated town, and he had some supporters from different walks of life. But I do want to talk about the issue of his conscientious objector. And I know we've heard this story, and can you just tell the listeners who maybe don't know about this a little bit about it, maybe some things that you learned that were not known before?
Yeah, it was really interesting. When Ali joined the Nation of Islam, he was soon after that drafted. And at first, when he took the test, he failed the IQ test, so he wasn't eligible for the military. And then when they needed more soldiers to call up for Vietnam, they lowered the number, the IQ test, and Ali was suddenly eligible. And he says, wait a second, I'm not any smarter than I was before. Why do they want me? He began by saying he didn't want to fight, that he was better off, fighting and making money. The government could tax him and buy tanks with all of his tax money. So he didn't exactly sound like a conscientious objector. Then he started saying, well, why would I want to go over there and fight a bunch of dark-skinned people when my country doesn't even treat its own dark-skinned people very well? Why do they want to send me over there to kill more brown-skinned people? I got nothing against those Viet Cong. So he's still not exactly sounding like a conscientious objector. And then, he sort of evolves and begins saying, well, my religion says that we don't fight in secular wars. We only fight in, the wars of the apocalypse. And that's where he drew the line. And we talked about Al Capone earlier and what a bad job he did of hiring lawyers. Well, young Muhammad Ali did a good job of hiring lawyers, and he got Chauncey Eskridge of Chicago to represent him. Chauncey Eskridge also represented Martin Luther King Jr. And Chauncey Eskridge and some other lawyers began making the case that that the Nation of Islam was a legitimate religion, and that Islam was a religion, even though it was only, you know, sort of tangentially connected to the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam was modeled after traditional Islam, but it was not the same thing. But they still made the case that Ali's religious beliefs were genuine. He sincerely believed that he was not permitted by his religion to fight. And that's the case they took to the Supreme Court. Ali was banned from boxing for 3.5 years while he fought this case. He was convicted of draft evasion, sentenced to prison. And while that case was on appeal, his boxing license was stripped, his passport was taken away, and he had to look for other ways to make a living while the case made its way through the courts.
And the resounding ruling was a unanimous opinion, if I'm not mistaken, that he was right.
Yeah, but it was a close call, actually. You know, that's one of the things I learned. It was very interesting. The Supreme Court was prepared to affirm the lower court's ruling that Ali was guilty and send him to jail. The Supreme Court had taken a tentative vote, and they were prepared. They weren't going to even rule on it. They were just going to decline to take the case from the lower court that had ruled against Ali. But they were worried about the PR. They were worried about how it would look to send this famous black man to prison without even giving him a hearing.
What, the Supreme Court political?
Yes. Yes. Shocking,
wait,
right?
I'm grabbing my pearls right now. Oh, my.
Even before our current court, these things happened. And they decided to look at the case again and to give it a little more time. And while they were doing that, one of the clerks for Justice Harlan actually read Elijah Muhammad's book, A Message to the Black Man, and made the case to Justice Harlan that really there was no difference between the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Nation of Islam, and that if one was granted a conscientious objector status, why shouldn't the other? And Justice Harlan managed to convince the other justices that this was right, but they still didn't want to rule in that way because they didn't want to set a precedent that all members of the Nation of Islam were exempt from military service. So they found a little technicality. They found a little mistake that one of the earlier courts had made, and they threw the case out on this technicality.
Wow.
So lots of politics going on here, lots of backroom drama.
Very interesting. Non-related, and I don't want to spend much time on it. I just thought he was so funny. Some of his quotes, if you Google Muhammad Ali quotes, I mean, so funny. My favorite was he said, "Frazier is so ugly that when he cries, the tears turn around and go down the back of his head." I love it. I just have to know, do you have any idea as to whether or not he came up with those himself, or did he have like a speech writer?
Well, he was very good at appropriating the works of others. he borrowed a lot from Dick Gregory, who was, you know, a friend,
right,
and a legendary comedian. But a lot of them were just Ali. And his buddy Boudini Brown, you know, came up with a few. But Ali was very funny and very fun to be around, and just had an unbelievably sharp wit. So when he failed the IQ test, for example, he said, I only said I was the greatest. I didn't say I was the smartest.
That's funny. You know what? We ran completely out of time. I do want to talk to you, and maybe we'll do this sooner rather than later. Birth of the Pill was one of your other books that talked about the development of the contraceptive pill. And with the Roe versus Wade impending, probably a reversal, I want to talk to you about how your research played into that. But we are out of time. Jonathan Eich, I highly recommend everyone buy his book, Get Capone or Ali, A Life, all excellent, excellent books. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks, Ken.